Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash from Building Bridges.
Walls or Bridges? Strategies for Rebuilding Communities with Deanna Buttu, legal advisor in the Negotiations Affairs Department of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and Tom Ngadi, professor, Hunter College Department of Urban Affairs and Planning, and author of Metropolis 2000, Planning, Poverty, and Politics. Cities are divided into enclaves by walls that segregate by privilege and race and ethnicity. At the same time, communities are struggling to rebuild bridges and networks that unite people. The Planners Network seeks to engage discussions about breaking down walls and building bridges through progressive planning strategies. Tom and Deanna, it is a pleasure to welcome you to Building Bridges. Tom, why don't you begin? You're a member of the Planners Network. And let's backtrack a little and say what planning is.
Well, planning is basically a profession that's based on a series of policies that build cities. Planners Network started in 1975 by a group of progressive planners who fought against the destruction of cities by urban renewal. And in tandem with the civil rights movement, we opposed the official planning, which was based on a series of national and local policies that specifically aimed to destroy central city neighborhoods, particularly communities of color, low-income communities of color, and to invest enormous amounts of money in the construction of the interstate highway system and the suburbs, which were exclusive enclaves. So planning is very much concerned with the building of not just cities, but metropolitan regions.
So, Tom, let's follow up on that by just talking more specifically about this conference, Walls or Bridges, Strategies for Rebuilding Communities. What do you want to get at with this conference?
The idea of the conference is to highlight the continuing destruction of communities, also to highlight the many examples of how people are uniting to build bridges. And we chose Israel to focus on and the occupied territories because this is probably one of the most dramatic examples on an international scale of how people are being divided through a conscious geopolitical strategy that's related to its urban strategy and an urban policy. Arabs, Palestinians are not allowed to build in certain places. Their homes are destroyed and demolished almost without reason, and the settlements are planned communities that are essentially gated communities. And the highways that are being built to them are exclusive highways that only Israelis are allowed to use. And this is also a reenactment of the Federal Urban Renewal Program because, once again, it's heavily financed by Washington.
I can think of Bantustans and black spots and, in general, apartheid or strategic hamlets in Vietnam or segregated and redlined neighborhoods here. The fact of the matter is that if you can control where people live, you can control how people live and how privilege unfolds and issues of supremacy that go along with that. And recently there was a study that said, despite what many people may think, that New York was one of the most segregated cities in the entire country. So you will have a cluster of people living of one ethnicity here or there, but certainly the intermeshing, a real multiculturalism, is something that is not part of New York. Well, with that, Deanna, let's bring you into the discussion. I guess the most blatant and aggressive indication of reactionary planning would be the construction of the wall that cuts communities in half and cuts, it would seem, the lifeblood of the Palestinian people. Is that how you understand the planning process and why you also chose to participate in the Planners Network conference?
Well, it's not so much a reactionary process as much as it is a very planned approach on the part of the Israeli government to try to divide Palestinian communities from one another in order to basically segregate Palestinians from one another, to prevent the idea of a national unity, to prevent national cohesion, to prevent Palestinians from being able to exercise any unity when it comes to everything from education to health care to even being able to access their places of employment. What Israel is now trying to do with the construction of the wall is confine the Palestinians into as little space as possible, thereby preventing Palestinians from doing everything from moving and also preventing them from accessing their much-needed agricultural and water resources. So the entire plan behind this wall is not simply a reactionary one, as Israel has actually labeled it, but one that's been strategically planned out to try to confine the Palestinians into as little space as possible while taking as much of their land as possible and using that land to expand and build Jewish-only settlements in the area.
And I think there's a parallel here in the United States as well. People say urban renewal was in the United States was a reaction. It wasn't a plan, their conscious policy. But it actually was laid out by national policy, the defense highway system. It was a geopolitical strategy to disperse the population and industry in the country with a conscious idea that cities would be less vulnerable to attack if they were dispersed. And the FHA consciously excluded blacks from getting mortgages in suburbs. So it was a very conscious process that led to the production of segregated cities and exclusive white suburbs.
Diana, when people think about the wall these days, these weeks anyway, they think mostly about Gaza, but it seems that what's going on in the West Bank is being obscured. Can you be more concrete about what the effect of the wall, the ongoing building of the wall, is having not only on the neighborhoods of Palestinians in the West Bank, but also the economy?
Absolutely. One of the reasons that the Gaza disengagement plan has been discussed and been discussed so fervently is to mask what's going on in the occupied West Bank. Sharon is the master of, he's sort of a magician in which he'll sort of pull out the rabbit from the hat and then, of course, obscure the fact that there's an ongoing colonization process that's taking place in the West Bank. So far within the West Bank, about one-third of the wall has already been built in the occupied West Bank. And Israel recently announced that it was going to go ahead with plans to continue to build the wall further into occupied Palestinian territory, even in light of an assurance that Sharon himself gave to President Bush that he wasn't going to continue this portion of the wall. Recently, it was actually just last week, the Israeli government announced that they were going to proceed ahead as planned. The second phase of the wall is going to cut about 26 kilometers into the West Bank. And 26 kilometers to some people doesn't sound like a whole lot of space, but when you think of the West Bank as being about the same size as Rhode Island, 26 kilometers is almost going into half of the territory of the West Bank. And so far, the impact of the already existing wall has been completely devastating on Palestinians. There's now a 70% unemployment rate in the occupied West Bank. 70% of Palestinians are living off of less than $2 a day. There are now 13,000 Palestinians who are trapped between the wall and between the Green Line. These are Palestinians who are living in enclaves, who cannot get to their jobs, they cannot get to see their families on the other side, and who quite literally need permission to be living in those areas. They have to carry around an identity card proving that they're resident in those areas, to be in those areas. There are about 100 homes that are slated for demolition because of the construction of the wall. And again, this is an arbitrarily chosen path of the wall. It's not being built on the Green Line, and so the homes that are going to be demolished are being demolished strictly because that's where Israel has chosen to build the wall. More importantly, you've got Palestinians who are now cut off from schools, from hospitals, and from their families. In some places, particularly in the northern part of the West Bank, Palestinians now need permission to go into hospitals because they cannot get beyond the wall to go to the major hospitals in the city. There's similarly children who are living on one side of the wall and go to school on the other side, who every day have to wait for the Israeli army to open up gates and fences for them to be able to simply access their schools. The level of despair has gotten so high that you can see that there will be long-term effects both on children and on the elderly, as well as those who are very ill, who cannot now access medical care in the way that they once were able to.
And the green line, how is that different from the wall? I'm confused about that.
The green line is the 1967 border. This was the area that Israel had up until 1967. It was Israel's border, and then following 1967 was the area that Israel then began an occupation of. So everything east of what's called the green line is the occupied West Bank, and in the Gaza Strip, similarly, there's a green line there. Where the wall is being built is not on that border. It's being built within occupied Palestinian territory, so it's not actually being built on Israel's border. It's going into Palestinian territory. So what Israel is doing is it's not building the wall on its international border, but is instead going into the territory of the Palestinians, taking their land and at the same time separating the people from their land in those areas.
Deanna, there is also a good deal of confusion about the plan by Arik Sharon on the pullout, presumably, in certain settlements in Gaza.
Right.
And as people focus on that, they don't seem to be cognizant of what this means for legitimizing the present borders in the West Bank. I was hoping that you could elaborate on the position of the Palestinian Liberation Organization in relationship to the plan that is being proposed by Arik Sharon.
As I was stating earlier, the Gaza Strip has been occupied since 1967, and there are about 21 settlements that are in the Gaza Strip. These are illegal, of course, under international law. And these 21 settlements have about 7,300 Israeli settlers living in them. These 7,300 settlers have been largely incentivized to go into the Gaza Strip. They're given housing reductions to move into the Gaza Strip. They get a 7% reduction on their income tax. In some cases, the housing is very inexpensive to the point where it becomes very economical for families to move into the occupied Gaza Strip. And Israel has in the past used these settlers as pawns to continue to try to take more Palestinian land, all in the name of saying that, you know, these settlers are there, what can we do about them? But largely ignoring the fact that it's Israel itself who's giving these settlers the incentive to move in to these areas.
But we are told to take heart now because there is a pullout of Gaza.
That's right, and there isn't going to be a pullout of Gaza. Ariel Sharon did not get the support of his party in order to support the withdrawal, the pullout of these settlements from the Gaza Strip. And most recently, when he did get support from his cabinet for this pullout plan, if you actually read very closely, there's no pullout at all whatsoever in the pullout plan, in the disengagement plan. So while Sharon says that eventually, at some point in time in the future, we don't even know when, there's going to be a withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, in fact, what's actually going to happen is that the settlers will remain. And just this past week, there have been more land confiscation orders in the Gaza Strip to expand some of the settlements in the Gaza Strip. So presumably if they're going to be withdrawing, then they wouldn't need to expand the settlements. But, of course, they're not going to be withdrawing. But more importantly, what Sharon is doing right now is he's trying to focus attention on the Gaza Strip and on this plan because people are quite sick and tired of the Middle East. They're tired of hearing about 3.5 years of violence and so on. And so this plan sounds as though it's a very appealing one. It sounds as though there's actually progress being made in the Middle East. But what he's really doing is he's using this as smoke and mirrors. He's talking about pullouts while at the same time expanding the settlements there. And more importantly, what he said is that in exchange for pulling out of these settlements from the Gaza Strip, which he's not going to do, he's then going to take land in the occupied West Bank. And the land that he's talking about taking and keeping in the occupied West Bank is perhaps the most fertile land in the occupied West Bank, and it includes one of the major water aquifers in the West Bank. So what he's in effect saying is, fine, you know, I'll pull out these 7,300 settlers from the Gaza Strip, but I'm going to make sure that there are going to be 60 to 80, if not more, thousand settlers who will remain in the parts of the West Bank that I've unilaterally chosen, not to mention the 200,000 settlers who currently reside in occupied East Jerusalem. So what he's trying to do is basically acquire more territory in the West Bank in exchange for a promise and to some point in time eventually withdraw from the Gaza Strip.
Tom and Gadi, I mean, after listening to this, and we're looking at the issues, of course, everything is relative, but we're looking at the issues of planning here. You and I have been involved in housing-based issues for decades now. How does this inform the kinds of things that you will be discussing at the Planners Network and our own situation in New York, where we are trying desperately, at least progressive planners such as yourself are trying progressively, to come up with some sort of egalitarian distribution of land and resources in an urban context.
There are many parallels, and there are many things that we can learn from examples all around the world. Here in New York City, one of our major plenary sessions is on environmental justice, because there are neighborhoods throughout New York City and other places in the United States. There'll be somebody coming from the Southwest Organizing Project. There's somebody coming from South Carolina to be part of this panel to talk about how communities of color, neighborhoods of color in cities and in rural areas are dumped on, have become enclaves for toxic wastes and for facilities that are not wanted in other areas, and with all of the environmental and public health consequences that follow from that. We also have several panels with activists who are involved in saving public housing. That's another item on the agenda for progressive planners, which is this whole wave of privatization that begins with Reagan counter-revolution of disinvesting in public services and also eliminating public spaces. Here in New York City, we see this post 9/11, in particular with the hysteria of the Homeland Security Act. We find that the sidewalks, the parks, the public spaces are being militarized. People are being prevented from expressing their rights. And who are the people who are excluded the most? Of course, it's the people who are speaking in opposition to the Republican Party. We're not even sure we're going to be able to get permission to demonstrate at the Republican National Convention in New York City. But obviously, the dissent will be expressed, but we are facing a police state. And the privatization of public space is happening all over in city parks. So that now we're told that because the Great Lawn of Central Park was restored with private funds, it can't be used for a public purpose.
Tom, I just wanted to ask one question about some of the major projects that Bloomberg is undertaking. I mean, they don't seem very major compared to what Ariel Sharon is doing, but still, actually, this is Pataki's plan to run the Long Island Railroad into downtown. Does that exacerbate, in your think, the flight to the suburbs, or does that help downtown?
It's helping downtown, and that's one of the other divisions in the city, is the creation of the business district enclaves. This administration's urban policy is to promote the expansion of the central business district. Midtown West, the Downtown Brooklyn Plan, Queens West, these are all mega projects that are going to have significant public subsidies to strengthen the luxury housing enclaves and the business districts at the expense of the neighborhoods, with clever new financing plans that will bring revenues to provide services for those enclaves while the schools in the rest of the city are hurting for money.
Deanna and Tom and Gotti, you are going to be participating both in a major conference. Deanna, for people of goodwill and conscience who want to reverse the trends, who want to take seriously the responsibility of people of conscience to oppose the outrageous occupation that has been in progress for decades now of the Palestinian land, what do you tell people to do?
There's a lot of things that can and perhaps should be done. One of the things is, of course, educating yourself in terms of what it is that's actually happening in the occupied West Bank and in the occupied Gaza Strip, because I think it's very important for people to realize that what they're reading on the pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever major newspaper are not exactly the things that are really happening there. Many of the things that happen go unreported, and most unfortunately, it's the long-term strategies that often go the most unreported, and that's what it is that is behind Israel's intention in terms of trying to build the wall and build the settlements and build the roads that connect the settlements to one another. So I really encourage people to educate themselves about what it is that's actually happening there, because I think that once you understand, then you cannot do anything but act, because you'll begin to realize that what's happening is a slow, squeezing of a people and confining them into these really tiny spaces. It's basically trying to mask them and make sure that you don't see them any longer. And so educating yourself is something that's very crucially important. But then there's also other things that can be done, which is educating others. There has to be a great deal of dissent when it comes to the major networks that we have in the United States that are not providing accurate information to those who do want to get the information, whether it's the Foxes, the CNNs, or the New York Times, or otherwise. Beyond that, of course, there's always work that can be done with elected officials, although it seems that this administration is pretty much hopeless with this administration, given that we've seen resolution after resolution calling Ariel Sharon a man of peace, somewhat laughable when you look at the refugee camps of Rafah and see what he's done there. But there's a lot of things that can be done here in terms of trying to galvanize support for these things. Other movements that are crucially important are divestment movements. These are the same movements that were very important trying to highlight the issue of South African apartheid. And I think that divestment is also a very good way, a very good method of trying to highlight what Israel's long-term strategy is towards the Palestinians. Finally, I think also just trying to visit Palestine, seeing for yourself what's happening there, trying to get involved in some of the grassroots work that's being done there, some of the protests, the nonviolent protests that nobody hears about. These are things that I think once you understand what's going on there, you cannot help but act. And I'm hoping that people will walk away with a sense that there is a lot that they can be doing to help the Palestinians get their freedom.
I would just add that there is an organization in the United States called the Rebuilding Alliance, which is at rebuildingalliance.org, that is working with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions.
Yes.
That people can connect with.
Yes, and that's a fantastic organization because what they're trying to do is rebuild Palestinian homes that have been demolished by the Israeli army. There are lots of organizations like that. For example, there's an organization in Palestine that tries through agriculture to make sure that Palestinian farmers are getting their land back and that they're reclaiming their land as well and making sure that the Israeli army is not confiscating their land. So there's a lot of work that can be done here and that perhaps should be done.
Just in closing, Deanna, you were talking about people getting more involved, and how did you get involved?
Oh, gosh. I got involved as a teenager. I was born and raised in Canada to Palestinian parents. Growing up, I remember my parents would often talk about being Palestinian, but I didn't really know what that meant. And in 1987, I had the opportunity to visit my family who live inside Israel in a city called Nazareth. When I arrived in the country, not knowing a lot about the area, I was very taken aback by the architecture and by the infrastructure that existed there, because there were Jewish communities inside Israel that were very well planned. They had lovely roads, they had parks and schools and green spaces and everything. And then when we drove up to Nazareth, I was struck by the fact that here were 70,000 people living on top of one another in a tiny little space with no parks, roads that were completely falling apart. I was struck by the fact that the people living there were all Palestinians. And things started to make an incredible amount of sense to me, even though I was only a teenager at the time. I was very struck by that image of seeing what it was like to be a Jewish Israeli and to be a Palestinian Israeli and the differential treatment being afforded to both peoples. And slowly I started to get involved by simply educating myself and understanding what was happening in the Middle East and by reading a lot of books. And it's that same image that took me in 1996 there, and again, this is following the signing of the Oslo Accords, and that still sits with me to this day. When you see what it's like for people of different religions in one territory to be living side by side and one class of people being afforded a lot more privileges and rights, and another not. It's that same image that I'm still struck with today.
Well, Deanna Bhutta, we're looking forward to having you to seen and speaking with you at the conference. And, of course, your plenary featured speaker. We have to reclaim our cities, and by doing that, we begin the process of building international movements to reclaim our world, the world of the working people. Well, Tom and Gotti, it is always a pleasure to have you. And one more time, the website so people can see the full panoply of speakers and workshops.
Thank you, Mimi. The website is www.plannersnetwork.org.
Well, Tom and Gotti, we thank you. Tom is a professor at Hunter College, Department of Urban Affairs and Planning, and Deanna Bhutta is legal advisor in the Negotiations Affairs Department of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Thank you for joining us, and we're going to hear David Robex sing about the wall.
building a wall. A wall between friends. A wall that justifies any means for their ends. A wall between Semites, rich and poor, brothers and sisters from not so long before. Many feet thick and 20 feet high, no one can look through it and into the eye of a person you might know, to whom you might confide. Now just a stranger on the other side. They're building a wall between water and land, so we can eat fruit and they can eat sand. A wall to make sure that our orchards will grow and our kids can get fat and not need to know of the cities in ruins and the children in fear that your fathers and brothers in tanks might be near. A wall to keep quiet that which you fear most, so you don't have to listen to your grandfather's ghost. They're building a wall between future and past. A wall to keep separate the chambers of gas from bulldozers, gunships, and the tears of a child. Dignity, love, and honor defiled. To remove reality from your facts on the ground. A wall to keep distant the terrible sound of the houses that crumble and the children that die. A wall to keep separate the truth from the lie. They're building a wall, and at such a cost, land, money, and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken and said, no more walls, no more refugees, no more keeping people upon their knees. And then the history books will someday recall, before apartheid was ended, they were building a wall.
And that was David Robeck's
Great
The Wall.
Song, really fantastic.
Yeah, and how it complements what Deanna Vuitton and Tom and Gotti were speaking about. This has been Building Bridges.
Bridges, your community and labor report.
And if you would like to get in touch with Building Bridges, you can email Mimi, that's M-I-M-I, at buildingbridgesonline.org. That's Mimi at Building Bridges Online. We'd like to hear from you.
Positive information can give you something, can give you what you ask for. Positive information can give you more, it can be everlasting. And some say, if your hand...